My name's Chris Hewitt. I specialise in business and IT journalism. I started off on local papers where they had a major story called the Birmingham pub bombings, which have never been satisfactorily resolved. I've also had major stories on Jimmy Savile in 1978, showing what dirty old so-and-so he was. I also got the Cyril Smith story the next year. I got the truth about Hillsborough about 4.5 hours afterwards. I knew that Robert Maxwell had got his hand in the till in 1986, etc. I'm very good at finding stories that the national media can't be bothered to print or check out properly.
Well, often I think maybe, Chris, it's the national media. Their lawyers tell them, oh, crikey, this person's so powerful, we need to double, quadruple and triple check this before we use it.
Oh, well, I've no problem with that. Because I don't offer stories that aren't haven't been properly checked out.
As we say, stood up.
That's right, yes.
Let's just run through some of those one by one. We're going to be talking about the whole Birmingham Six story in a minute. But what about 1978 with Jimmy Savile? What did you dig out? You were well ahead of the game there.
Yeah. I knew from when I was at uni that Savile liked underage girls, because when we had our rag ball, I spoke to a contact in the record business, and he said, he asked me how old the youngest girls were at uni. I said 18, and he told me he likes them much younger than that. When I started checking him out, my mate Pete Waterman warned me. He said, I'm off on a business trip. He said, if you see Savile going in with my kid, thump him. I then started checking him out and asking police sources. Savile had been arrested on at least 6 occasions. On each and every occasion, he was released on the orders of Special Branch, which normally means he's working for the security services.
So that is in the 1970s you're talking about here?
Yeah. I mean, the next year, Cyril Smith was arrested in public toilets in Birmingham by the Vice Squad for offences against an underage youth. I remember the head of the Vice Squad jumping up and down for joy. They got the dirty so-and-so at last. When this went up to the Director of Public Prosecutions, they decided not to prosecute because it would make it look as if it was an establishment plot against the Liberal Party. So he was also been arrested on at least 6 occasions for offences involving kiddie porn and underage kids. And on each and every occasion, he was also released on the orders of Special Branch. And one famous case, the chief constable even went and managed to lose the evidence.
Well, Cyril Smith was a horrific character, but Savile really was probably the worst paedophile the country's ever seen. And yet there
was
TV programs.
Yeah, but I mean, a lot of people at the BBC knew fully well what Savile was up to. If you look at the sort of people who run the BBC, a lot of them are very weak characters. That's the problem with having very powerful, you know, very strong-willed director generals.
What was going on with Savile then? How come you think he could? I mean, you can understand an MP may have some sort of establishment protection, but somehow Savile seems to have had the protection too, even though he was just a lowly DJ.
No, he wasn't. The MI5 was, if you're going back to the 70s, 60s and 70s, MI5 was paranoid about the BBC. They believed that many key decision makers were taking Russian gold. And I think that's the reason that Savile was allowed to get away with it, because he did have access to all these meetings, you know, senior executive level meetings and planning meetings and policy meetings. You know, like I said, and you might think he was only a lowly DJ, but he had far more to do with policy making the BBC than he's ever been given credit for. Largely, it was out of fear.
How do you know that, though, Chris?
Well, I've got lots of friends who were in my National Union of Journalists, who worked for the BBC. And you speak to the retired ones, they will tell you that that monster got away with murder because, they were, you know, so many of the management were afraid to hand him over to the police.
I suppose once they know that he's actually not going to get prosecuted, then they have to go somewhere else. I certainly remember looking at, and I was chatting to Don Hale, who you might know.
Yes, I know Don, yes.
About Saville, and he said that, well, actually, it was Jill Dando handed over a whole dossier on Saville and other people who had been protecting at the BBC to Paul Condon, who was at the time the Metropolitan Commissioner.
Yeah.
And it was literally about 2 months later that she was shot dead on her doorstep.
Yeah, yeah. But I wouldn't credit Saville with that, because he, honestly, he prefers them alive. And anyway, she was too old.
Well, no, I don't think I'm trying to imply that.
No.
There obviously was a ring protecting Saville. And making
there's no question about it.
He was above the law.
Yes, well, yes, and I think he knew it and enjoyed it.
Yeah. What about Hillsborough? How did you find out about that?
Well, I was taking the dog out for a walk before going down the pub. A group of policemen knew I was a working journalist. They called me over and they told me that had I watched the telly and said yes. And he said the superintendent in charge of Hillsborough lost his bottle and panicked. Did a Corporal Jones, you know, don't panic, don't panic. He completely lost control of the affairs, and he said when their colleagues were got back to the police stations, they were told to sign bogus complaints and confessions, and that's, you know, they were very, very angry about it. But again, you know, the national media just weren't interested. I mean, you know, and they come out with this appalling piece of stupidity about the if the Liverpool fans started it all.
Yeah, absolutely appalling to blame them.
I actually tried selling it to, you know, you would have thought that the News of the World and the Sun and papers like that would have bitten my hand off for, you know, for probably one of the most important stories of the year. But, you know, I didn't even get a thanks, but no thanks.
So did you manage to get the stuff about Saville, Cyril Smith and the Hillsborough? Did you get it into print in Birmingham?
No.
Well, this is a frustrating thing, isn't it? When journalists know about stuff, they've stood the story up to their own satisfaction, but even a journalist can't get it into print. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the people who owned the Birmingham Post and Mail then, the Arliff family, they were very senior members of the Freemasons. They certainly had a lot of friends in the police, especially the publisher, Tim Morris, who was well known for... using his influence. He was a Mason of grand rank, and he didn't lose any sleep about using that to get what he wanted.
What about Robert Maxwell then? What did you get to dig out about him?
Well, my headmaster served in Special Forces with Maxwell, Special Operations Executive, and he said he was probably our best field agent. But he said, don't ever work for him because he uses the same tactics in business. So I said, well, he means you use the minimum of his own resources, the maximum of everyone else. He said, the headmaster said, got it in one. Maxwell got the mirror stitched up by effectively bribing senior managers not to oppose his takeover. Maxwell was a very, very clever. He was a very, very clever man. He liked psychological games. He was very, very good at. And again, a lot of people in the mirror, despite all their, despite the fact that they always reckon they were tougher than the Sun, the reality was they were just like a lot of BBC people, you know, they're weak. Maxwell was proposed to issue new capital to buy more companies. Well, I was interviewing a leading light in the city on the reinsurance market, for Insurance Today magazine, and I said at the end of it, I suppose you've heard the joke story about Maxwell, he's going to issue new capital, and the bloke looked me straight in the face and he said, under the current law you can't issue new capital unless your pension fund is fully paid up to date. Do I have to say any more? And when you started checking out, people went, you know, you started trying to find out what Maxwell had been doing to the pension fund, you sort of got a wall of silence, even people who claimed that they were good militant trade unionists.
Why?
Well, because, again, Maxwell was a very powerful person, so many people were afraid of him. I mean, when I used to work for IPC when it owned the Mirror. Now, when my division of IPC moved to Sutton in Surrey, I could either have redundancy or a job on the Mirror. I applied for a job on the Mirror, And apparently there was a secret committee set up to try and find a reason not to give me one, even though the group, even though I had the support of the group personnel director, because he just could not understand why the Mirror hadn't given me a post, given my contacts in the Labour Party and the TUC. And the group personnel director was a Tory. You know, he just couldn't understand their decisions. But I think it's because they knew that I wouldn't let Maxwell get away with anything. I mean, if I had had a job on the Mirror, Maxwell and his cohorts would be set, would have been selling mailbags for a few years.
Okay. Well, okay, so what about his links to the Mossad? There's lots of rumours about that. He's even buried...
Maxwell was a triple agent. He was working for MI5, KGB, but his true boss of bosses was Mossad, which is the Israeli equivalent of MI6. That's why he's buried in the special place reserved for Israel's most important supporters and citizens.
Well, yes, but I mean, that isn't necessarily mean he's working for the Mossad. What other evidence have you got that he was?
Well, some of his supporters only after his death, I think Mossad did grudgingly admit that Maxwell was one of theirs. But you see, one of the reasons he was popular with the security spooks is because he knew so many of the top brass in Eastern Europe on first name terms. Mm. He was a very clever psychologist. What he did is he went around to see the leaders of all the Eastern European countries and offered to publish their memoirs in the UK. So he sort of go in and he'd give them six or seven simple questions, and then he'd tape record it, and then that, he'd just stick that into a book and, you know, print off 1,000 copies, which they then gave out to all their mates, and they thought he was very wonderful, because they also started saying things that perhaps they shouldn't have done if their security chiefs had been in the room. But basically, he was certainly very, very influential, and we don't know the level of support or deals that he did behind the Iron Curtain, but certainly believe that he helped get people released.
Well, he died in very peculiar circumstances, didn't he?
No, he committed suicide. It's typical of Maxwell to make it look as if there's a question mark. Like I said, he's a very clever man. You see, if the coroner ruled he'd committed suicide, then his wife wouldn't have got the whopping great life insurance. So he got a very tough anti-suicide clause in it. Right? But, he topped himself. You see, he had to pay either $60 million in cash or banker's draft to Credit Suisse by midday the next day, which he couldn't do. That would have meant that Credit Suisse would immediately suspend his account and use the interbank network to inform all the other countries in the world that to shut Maxwell's accounts. So he'd have had a bankruptcy hearing in most of the countries in the world. And Maxwell could only get away with telling his whoppers for so long.
Don't you think it's possible that an agency as professional as the Mossad might have disappeared him?
Maxwell wouldn't need Mossad's help to do that. He was certainly clever enough to do that without anyone's help.
Well, to change his identity and basically pop up.
He was probably our top agent in SOE. He wouldn't have any problem getting false passports, plastic surgery, etc. But in fact, most people at the Mirror at the time didn't believe he'd topped himself. We actually had to show them the autopsy pictures.
Oh, right, really? So even his own staff didn't believe him?
No. I mean, there were still plenty of people in the Mirror who believe he's alive somewhere somewhere where there's no... It has to be someone who has an extradition treaty.
What about his interesting... His daughter has come to prominence, hasn't she, recently?
Ghislaine? She's Daddy's favourite girl. His yacht was named after her. There's a friend of mine who was a freelance accountant, and he once was commissioned to go and audit Maxwell's accounts at Headington Hall in Oxford. And he said it's the only time in his life he'd ever walked out on a job. He said, "You think Maxwell was bad? His daughter was even worse."
What, you mean juggling money around and sort of...
Being generally nasty and frightening people.
Oh, right. Threats, this sort of thing.
Yeah. In fact, the APD is it isn't her father in jail as well.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, look, we didn't come to talk about this. We came to talk about the Birmingham pub bombings, Chris, didn't we? And we've seen some big developments on that over the last week or so, with Chris Mullin being threatened with he's got to reveal his sources. And I mean, what the hell's going on here? Why pick on? Well, I mean, what was his involvement in the whole case? Because this is one of the worst miscarriages of justice in British history.
Yeah, he literally got complaints from all the people who tried to get their own MPs doing it, and they wouldn't, because one thing about Chris, he was a bit like Dave Nellist in Coventry or Tony Benn or people like that. They would take up very unpopular cases that nobody else would touch.
So he's an ex-MP, isn't he, Chris Mullin, ex-Labour MP?
Yeah, he's ex-Labour MP, and he was also he was by profession a journalist. He's certainly getting letters from people who knew the Birmingham Six were innocent and couldn't get their own MPs to raise them. Now, I did tell Chris that 3 days after the Birmingham pub bombings, I was walking past Coventry Police Headquarters and I was called over by, this was about 2:10, and I was called over by a group of about half a dozen coppers who knew I was a working journalist. And they told me the serious crime squad had arrested the wrong people. And now, obviously, I couldn't know. Well, I think they're all dead anyway. But they couldn't. They had to stay off the record because they would have, if they'd gone public, they'd have probably lost their jobs. Now, when I interviewed Sir Philip Knight, the late Chief Constable of West Midlands, in the 9th of May 1984, I asked him about this because said Sir Philip, I'm increasingly finding it difficult to find any of your officers who believe the Birmingham Six are guilty, you know. And he said, oh, no. He said, I read the file before you arrived. The evidence is overwhelming. It's particularly surprising because Knights was normally pretty straight with the media.
So what's the significance of the journalist MP, Chris Mullin, being told he's got to reveal his sources?
Well, I can't understand it because nearly everyone involved are dead. You know, like I said, when Chris made that programme, I think if he'd walked up to, you know, two or three dozen West Midlands coppers in the street, they would have told you they believe the Birmingham Six are innocent. You know,
it's probably even before it was exposed.
Yeah, I think it was about 85 because. And because there was a very good TV program made on it, and
World in Action, I think
that's right, something like that. Yes, and you know, it was very well done. And there was also a TV play on it, where they had Martin Shaw, you know, of the Professionals, playing the one of the investigative journalists. And but he said, I just do not understand it. I mean, I can think of far more important collars that want measuring.
Interestingly, you mentioned the Freemasons in connection with Hillsborough, but what about and possibly with other things? But that definitely was a very big interest of Chris Mullin's, wasn't it?
Yes. Although I must say that the vast majority of Freemasons are honest, law-abiding citizens. Until an expose came out on it. Stephen Knight's expose of it, it was almost impossible to get expelled. But since then, the Masons have disciplined more people than they've done in the previous 500 years put together.
Well, certainly from my experience, they've been disciplining the wrong people, getting the best people out, the honest ones out.
Well, it's not actually them. It's unscrupulous people using the Brotherhood for their own ends, which I might actually add is an expulsion offence.
Mm. What, so he did, I think he also, was. Am I right in thinking he was responsible for the film, a brilliant film called A Very British Coup?
He might well have been, that's the one starring Ray McAnally as a Labour Prime Minister who the establishment trying to get rid of.
Yeah, I must admit, when I was seeing Jeremy Corbyn being hauled over the coals, I mean, although obviously, you know, the guy in the film is a Prime Minister that's being bullied, I mean, I think wasn't it based on the Wilson plot?
Yes. Yeah. So towards the end of his life, Harold did start getting a bit paranoid. he said, when he said the country, he said the country was becoming ungovernable. And I think it's because, well, look, when Wilson won in 64, senior civil servants were openly going around saying that, you know, that our government had lost the election, namely Alex Douglas Hume. See, senior civil servants don't like Labour governments because they actually try, because they have to earn their money.
Well, yeah, but I'm what I'm worried about is that maybe he wasn't paranoid. Maybe Harold Wilson was right. He said that the homes of cabinet ministers were being broken into and nothing was taken.
Well, most burglaries are opportunistic, and if they were broken into by the spooks would have done a very professional job.
Anyway, back to, let's just round off by going back to the Birmingham 6 story.
Yeah.
It's kind of been left hanging, hasn't it, the whole thing?
Yeah.
And it seems bizarre to me that Chris Mullins is being, you know, it's almost like the law has turned on its head, where the only person who was really put all their weight in, I'm not saying he was the only one, but he was certainly the main one, into overturning a clear and disgusting miscarriage of justice, is now facing prosecution themselves.
Yeah, well, I think it's a last desperate attempt. See, there are still members of the establishment who believe the Birmingham Six were guilty. I think the aim is to try and get him to. To sue them for defamation in the civil court, where you've got a lower standard of proof. That's always been the aim of those who still believe the Birmingham Six are guilty, because they want him to call evidence to witnesses. But I certainly stand by Chris because I think he did a superb job. Even if you take the new coroner's inquest, I wrote two or three times to be asked to call a witness. I didn't even get a thanks, but no thanks, because it was never put on the record. There were three bombs, not two. The third bomb had been planted after the arrests had been made. Because it was planted in this Selly Oak police station.
How do you know that?
Again, it's not one of the closest kept secrets in the West Midlands police. I think if you asked any officers who were around, certainly at the time of the pub bombing, I think you'd find a lot of them would tell you they don't understand why the Serious Crime Squad didn't take into account the third bomb planted after these six were arrested. Because obviously they're in police custody, they couldn't possibly have planted it.
No, interesting. No, I mean, it's amazing, really, the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four, two horrendous miscarriages of justice, and it does make you wonder how decent our justice system is, doesn't it, when it comes to massive, important political crimes like that.
Yeah. Well, one of the weaknesses of the judges is they tend to believe that, if you're going back over those years, they tended to believe that police all told the truth and that businessmen in posh suits didn't commit crimes. I think that if these cases were to come again, I think most current judges are aware that the police have manipulated the evidence on many occasions. And this is not a recent phenomenon. I mean, it goes right back to the 1950s. When it's like if you take, say, the ghastly Dr. Bodkin Adams, he was charged with murdering his patients to get their insurance because a lot of them had left him lots of money in their wills. Now, the investigating officer actually told the bloke to his face, "I'm going to get you, I'm going to have you hanged," despite the fact, of course, the jury quite rightly found him not guilty.
Okay, look, finally, Chris, with the Savile thing has re-erupted again recently, with fingers being pointed by Boris and others, actually, at Keir Starmer for his role at not prosecuting him. Now, I think, isn't it, Alison, someone or other, QC anyway, did a report at the Crown Prosecution Service and said there were four separate possible prosecutions where the Sussex and Surrey police did, not as in your case, there was no charges. There were charges and they were presented to the Crown Prosecution Service under Keir Starmer. And although apparently Starmer had nothing to do with it, all those four sets of evidence for charges were rejected by the Crown Prosecution Service. So, that was all before Savile died. Obviously, the truth came out. but only just after he died. Well, what are your thoughts about whether Starmer really is or isn't in any way culpable for this, you know, failure to prosecute the guy?
If Starmer had been given all the information about the number of times Savile had been arrested and he's released on the orders of the special branch, he's a tough cookie. He would have pressed charges. And he'd also had special branching, wants to know why they kept on letting this monster off.
How many times?
He was arrested on at least 6 occasions for offences against underage girls. And on each every occasion, he was let off on the orders of special branch. I mean, that's only normal. That would only normally happen if he was an intelligence asset.
Interesting. All right, Chris, how do people follow your stuff? Are you on Twitter and on social media at all?
I'm on social media. I mean, since lockdown, of course, I find I've got a lot more friends who are, you know, obviously putting me on their circulation list, and I reply back to him. And certainly regarding Starmer, I have defended Keith's problem. I mean, you want the biggest naughty was that the assistant director of public prosecutions at one time was actually the wife of Mark Carlisle QC, one of the country's leading liberals. And I'd like to know any input she had with ensuring that Savile wasn't prosecuted, because that's never come out.
So anyway, how do people follow your work, Chris?
Well, I don't get very much these days. Part of the problem is there's a lot of the younger people in particularly technical journalism don't like old gits like me, because we actually know what we're talking about.
Well, no, but what I mean is, if people want to follow what you're up to these days, can people follow you on social media or anywhere like that?
No, well, they can send me on Facebook. I normally do them best to reply the same day. But there are lots and lots of people who do include me on their circulation list, so I'm able to reply back and say, etc. I mean, certainly I've reminded people on a number of my friends or lists I'm on that Savile was arrested on at least 6 occasions and let go on orders of special branch.
Okay, so if people want to find you on Facebook, is it just Chris Hewitt?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so that's Chris, Chris Hewitt.
That's right, yes.
Okay, Chris, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.